SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
This week, a woman who helps people tap into their creative side.
Creativity is just like any other set of skills. It requires some knowledge about how do you actually solve problems, but there are a whole set of skills that you can learn.
A college professor and author who believes that sometimes the best solution starts with a better question.
Einstein is quoted as saying, if my life depended upon the solution and I had 1 hour to solve the problem, I'd spend the first 55 minutes framing the problem.
Today on Stanford Pathfinders, faculty director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, Tina Seelig. Here's your host, Howard Wolf.
There is much talk these days about creativity and innovation. No business conference seems complete without at least a half dozen sessions dedicated to these topics. And bookstores, both virtual and real, are packed with titles addressing the same. We all trumpet the innovation economy and want to be a part of it. Our public and private universities, as the R&D engines of our country, are also focused deeply on creativity and innovation. This is partly because these qualities are essential to knowledge creation, but it is also partly because they are the building blocks for another much hoped-for byproduct, entrepreneurship. Stanford has a long and rich history in these worlds. Entrepreneurship is, quite simply, a fundamental part of the DNA of the university. But that begs a vital question. Can innovation, creativity, and entrepreneurship be taught? Or are these qualities instead innate and therefore fundamentally not teachable? Our guest on this edition of Stanford Pathfinders has strong opinions on this topic. Tina Seelig is professor of the practice in the Department of Management, Science, and Engineering at Stanford. She is also faculty director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, the Entrepreneurship Center at Stanford School of Engineering. She also teaches courses on creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship, and at the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford, fondly called the D School here on campus. She has written 17 books and educational games, all on the topics of innovation, creativity, and entrepreneurship. We could not have a better guest to opine on these important topics. Tina, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
So let's start out with the most obvious question for me of you. How does someone with a PhD in neuroscience end up leaving that world and diving into this entrepreneurship and creativity space? How does that happen?
Honestly, I could tell you the story as if it makes perfect sense and was completely crafted and preordained, or I could tell the story as a series of sort of surprising opportunities.
Serendipity. It's
a combination of those. Honestly, I have always been sort of open-minded and curious and just keep opening doors and interesting things happen. I mean, the story is, it does make sense if you look at it through a certain set of angles. For example, my interest in neuroscience came about because I was interested in creative problem solving. How do we think? How do we solve problems? How do we understand the world around us? And now I teach people how to do that. So it essentially is looking at the world, the same problems, but from a different angle.
I've read many of your books, as you know, and I've attended many of your lectures as well. And you say that qualities like being imaginative and innovative and ingenious are not something we're necessarily born with, but instead you say that these are skills that we can learn. So is that true? Can we all learn to be creative?
Okay, so Howard, I get asked this question all the time.
I imagine you do.
And it's such an interesting question because would you ever ask someone if you could learn science or math or history? No, we assume those are things you can learn, but somehow we get taught when we're young that we're either creative or we're not. You know, it's like saying you're tall or you're short, you have brown eyes or blue eyes. But In reality, creativity is just like any other set of skills. It requires some knowledge about how do you actually solve the problems, but there are a whole set of skills that you can learn, you can master, and you can really become quite adept, even if you didn't think you were initially creative. In fact, I have some fun examples where I have students in my classes who really at the beginning say, you know, I'm not really creative, I'm doing this, you know, but I really am not creative. And at the end, they can't believe how creative they are because they've been given not only an environment where this is fostered, but a set of tools and the opportunity to practice them that allows them to really hone these skills.
So I don't consider myself wonderfully creative.
Oh, come on.
I've never considered myself.
You're one of the most creative people I know.
Okay, you're very kind, but I don't think of myself that way. Is it that creativity is inside all of us, we just have to figure out a way to unleash it?
Well, you wouldn't have been able to get dressed today and come here if you weren't a creative problem solver, right?
How do you think I did, by the way?
Yeah, you did a great job.
Thank you
honestly,
so much.
Honestly, match and everything. You had to open up your closet. You had to imagine what you were going to need today, what sort of situations you were going to be in, who you were going to meet, what the temperature was going to be. You had a lot of information you had to put together to solve that problem. Now, obviously, everybody does that. People get up in the morning, they open their closet, they get dressed. These skills that you're using can just be taken to a higher and higher level. Eventually, you're solving bigger and bigger problems. In fact, that's what I do in my classes. I start out by giving the students really simple problems to solve so they gain their confidence and they start essentially polishing these skills to the point where they then start feeling like, wow, give me anything. I can take on any challenge.
So this term creative confidence, this is a big term these days, right? So the idea that if we could just make people more confident in their creativity, they would a priori become creative.
So David Kelly coined that term, and I really love it, creative confidence. It rolls off the tongue. But I think of this as a multifaceted issue. There is a set of knowledge, just like in any field. There are knowledge you need to know, there are skills you need to have, and there's a mindset. The mindset or the creative confidence is one piece of the puzzle, but you need to have skills. The things that we teach in our classes are very, very meaningful. How do you frame problems? How do you connect and combine ideas? How do you understand and challenge assumptions? How do you push beyond the first obvious answers? And these are things that you can get really good at. Of course, you need to have the right mindset in order to do it because these things are actually hard to do. And so if you're not confident that the process is going to work, you're probably going to give up before you get to a meaningful answer.
So it's not as if we all have to be artists or musicians or the obvious creative people to be creative. We all have it in us. We just have to have the skills, the mindset to allow it to flourish.
Exactly. And of course, just like anything else, just like sports or math or music, some people are much more naturally talented. Let's not deny that. There's some people who this comes really easily to them, but everyone can get better. Just like everyone can learn how to play soccer, even if you're not going to be playing in the World Cup, we can all kick a ball around a soccer field and get some exercise and learn the rules of the game and actually maybe even score a goal. It's just the same as with math. We teach everybody the basics of math in school, even though some people are going to go on and get a PhD.
So you play many roles here at Stanford. You remember the faculty, you lead different programs, you're an author, you do all this stuff. But one of the things you're also in charge of is what's called the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, which is essentially the entrepreneurship center within the School of Engineering. So I want to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship. You say that we can all be entrepreneurs, at least in our own way. But I've got to ask this question. Is this really viable? What about those allergic to risk or those for whom taking leaps of faith is just too difficult? It's simply anathema to them. I mean, is it really viable that we all can be entrepreneurs?
It all starts with your definition of entrepreneurship.
All right, what is an entrepreneur?
So if you come to our office, you'll see two big signs painted on the wall. And these are very front and center, not just on the wall, but in our minds. One says, every problem is an opportunity. The bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity.
So every problem is an opportunity, okay.
And the idea is that the world is filled with challenges, but if you have the right mindset, you can look at these as opportunities. The other sign says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. The idea is about leveraging resources to make things happen.
So anyone who does that
is an entrepreneur.
Is an entrepreneur.
And so it's not about starting a company.
You don't have to be Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, Jeff Bezos or whatever the case may be. You can be someone, you can be an entrepreneur in your regular life.
Exactly. You could be an entrepreneurial parent. I view myself as an entrepreneurial educator, right? I'm always looking around and seeing the problems in front of me as opportunities. I'm leveraging the resources I have in the community, and then I'm making things happen, whether it's building new programs, bringing people together, creating things that didn't exist before.
So the common definition of entrepreneurship is actually too limiting.
The one that people think about, and in fact, this is a huge problem, because people think that entrepreneurship is really all about making money, and it's not. Entrepreneurship is about creating value. Now, money might be one type of value you create, but actually, I always think of money as a tool, as just one more tool in your toolbox. Value is measured in lots of different ways. For example, I give lots of really kind of funny assignments to my students. I might give them a handful of paper clips or post-it notes or water bottles and say, create as much value as possible, value measured any way you want, starting with these materials. So the idea is that to get them to look at the things around them that seem mundane and then leverage those to solve problems that are in their midst.
This is a big discussion point here in Silicon Valley, and that is, do companies exist to make money, to create value, or to solve problems? So you're an entrepreneurship professor. Should companies solve problems?
People are motivated by really different things. And it would be naive of me to say that's the only thing that drives people. From my experience, those people who are really motivated to solve a big problem are usually going to be much more successful than those people who have just been motivated to make money. There are lots of easier ways and higher probability ways to make money than being the founder of a company. We know that 9 out of 10 companies fail, and therefore it's really a very high-risk endeavor. So if you're just motivated by money, you're probably in the wrong business. If you're motivated to really solve a problem, that's the right place to be.
There's a lot of literature that says that when we're children, we're wonderfully creative. And then over time, we seemingly become less creative. Is that because the creativity gets beat out of us through the system of education and just the vagaries of life? Or what's going on there? And how do we tap into that inner child that was so creative?
So isn't it sad we have two people who were in higher education talking about education beating creativity out of people?
Being the problem.
I know. And in fact, it's a huge issue. The problem is that our education system is so focused on metrics for success. And how do we measure that someone has learned something? And there's some things that are really hard to measure. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, not all things that count can be counted, and not all things that can be counted, count.
Right.
So the problem is creativity, love, ethics. These are things that are really hard to measure.
They're fuzzy.
And in fact, it's not that they're just hard to measure in the short run. They often are not actually manifest for years to come. It's like planting a seed that takes a long time to germinate.
Yes.
And then you're not really sure whether someone is ethical or knows how to be a good partner or knows how to solve problems until much later in life when they actually have the opportunity to really use those skills. And so we give a lot of assignments that have one right answer that are easy to grade.
In school.
And as a result, people get really good at that type of evaluation, test taking. And when they get out of school and are faced with open-ended problems without one right answer, they freeze because they haven't been trained to do that. I do believe that educators are now becoming much more interested in this. And I've seen many examples in universities and in K-12 environments when they really are saying, hey, we really do need to create opportunities for students to really hone their creative problem-solving skills. But I'm often quite embarrassed that the things I'm teaching, that I'm teaching to grad students, the students sometimes get very frustrated and they say, I cannot believe I had to wait to grad school to learn these things. I would have been so much more successful in my life to date if I had had these skills earlier on.
And reading some of your books, some of this can be very simple, right? So the mathematics problem that is in your book, and as opposed to asking, what is 5 plus 5, and I'm guessing that's 10, right?
You're good, good.
Thank you very much. You could ask it another way.
Yeah, so you could turn it around and say, what two numbers add up to 10? So you go from a problem with one right answer, what's the sum of 5 plus 5? You flip it on its head and you say, what two numbers add up to 10?
And that's an infinite.
Infinite number, negative numbers, fractions, decimals. I remember exactly where I was standing when that problem popped into my head, and I thought, that's the point. We need to really be thinking about how do we reframe the problem. So once I started really looking into the literature about reframing, it became clear that this is something that big thinkers have considered a long time. Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, if I had a daunting problem to solve, if my life depended upon the solution and I had 1 hour to solve the problem, I'd spend the first 55 minutes framing the problem. Because once I frame the problem correctly, the answer would become obvious.
So we spend too little time framing.
Exactly. What happens is people rush to the solution. And one of the things that my colleagues and I talk about all the time is having students fall in love with the problem, not the solution. If you really have a problem you want to solve, spend an inordinate amount of time in that problem space. I force my students to do this. They spend weeks just chewing on the problem and framestorming, essentially brainstorming.
Oh, so not brainstorming, framestorming.
Framestorming, essentially brainstorming
that.
Around the frame of the question. Do you want me to give an example?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm going to reveal that we realize that we have the same birthday.
Yes, we do.
Okay, and it's coming up. So we could brainstorm about the best birthday party that we could have. And that might sound like a good idea. But if we change one word in that prompt from birthday party to birthday celebration, we open up the frame and end up with many more solutions. Or we could say, what's the best way to mark our birthday? I mean, maybe we should have some statues in the quad, you know, next to the burgers of Calais, right? Or maybe we want the best birthday present, or the best birthday surprise, or the best birthday tradition. Each one of these questions opens up the frame in a different way to unlock a very different set of solutions.
So framing is fundamental to unleashing creativity.
Absolutely. In fact, Paul Yock, who's a colleague of mine at the medical school, he says that a properly framed problem is the DNA of the solution. You know, it's sort of that if you don't have that question properly framed, you're missing a huge opportunity.
All right, so let's talk about a couple of three words that get thrown around as if they're synonyms, but I'm guessing that you don't think they are. So words like innovation, creativity, and imagination. Are those all the same thing?
I love that you asked me this because I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I teach a class called Creativity and Innovation. And a couple of years ago, I realized that I was, even though I don't think I was doing anything that hurt anyone in the class, but that I was using these terms interchangeably and was doing a lot of hand waving. So I spent a lot of time thinking about how can we more crisply define these terms in a way that would allow us to squeeze more juice out of them. And think about it. I'm a scientist. We have very clearly defined terms, force, mass, acceleration. We know the relationships between them. You know, without that, the buildings would fall down. Okay? You know, we wouldn't be able to send rockets into space. So we have given ourselves permission to use very loose language around the process of generating ideas, and I think it's a missed opportunity.
So this is the fuzziness again.
Exactly.
It's getting in the way.
But I came up with a framework that I've been using in my class for the last couple of years, and it's really been really helpful to me. The idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't exist. Pretty simple?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Creativity is applying your imagination to solve a problem. So it's applying your ability to envision things that don't exist to solve a problem. Like you're getting dressed this morning, or if you were hungry, opening the refrigerator and figuring out how to make a peanut butter sandwich. Innovation is applying your creativity to come up with a unique solution. So the idea is that creative ideas are new to you, but innovative ideas are new to the world.
So they're a continuum of sorts.
Exactly. And then entrepreneurship is applying the innovation to scale the solution and bring it to the world.
This is Stanford Pathfinders, and I'm Howard Wolf. More with Tina Selig, author and faculty director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, coming up. This is Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM Insight 121. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with author and faculty director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program, Tina Selig. All right, so let's talk about something very important here at Stanford and in Silicon Valley, and it's the topic of failure. So here in the Valley and at Stanford, folks seem to embrace the concept of failure, provided one fails forward. But failure is daunting to most people. And most people that think about being entrepreneurs are worried about failure. So how does failure get in the way of innovation and creativity in entrepreneurship? And what do we do about it?
So people always say, oh, in Silicon Valley, we celebrate failure. And on some level, that's true. But really, no one wants to fail. And no one wants to invest in a failure. So let's be honest. Failure is a drag. Okay? But you have to realize that all learning results from trial and error. I'm pretty sure that you didn't walk the first time you tried or ride a bicycle the first time you tried. You got up, you failed, you got up, you failed, and then eventually you figured it out.
Right.
And this is true when we're adults as well. I'm not quite sure why it is that as adults we're expected to do everything correctly the first time without a failure. It's totally unrealistic, especially if it's something that nobody has done before. So I love the idea of thinking of failure as data. As a scientist, when you do an experiment and the results come out different than you expected, you look at that data and you say, wow, that's really interesting. I have a lot to learn here. Because if it came out just as you expected, you probably are doing something incremental. But if it comes out with some really unexpected results, there's a lot more to learn from that.
So I saw a sign, a poster recently in an office that I was walking by, and it had vertically fail, F-A-I-L, and it said first attempt in learning.
Exactly.
Fail.
Right. And it doesn't mean it's easy, but I have my students write failure resumes. So their biggest screw-ups.
A failure resume.
Yeah. You think these Stanford students like that. But at first, they're not particularly comfortable, and then they get really into it because they get to write their biggest failures, personal, professional, and academic. But it's not good enough to just write down the failure. You actually have to write down what you learned from it. And it's funny because in one of my books, in What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, I was talking about this, and a student who I had read an advanced copy said, gosh, I'd really like to see what one looked like. And I thought, well, who should I include? Maybe my husband's. I thought, no, I need to put in my own. So I wrote my own failure resume and included it. And it was such an interesting experience. I really, truly wish I had kept a failure resume since I was 20, because the process of actually mining your failures for learning is really powerful. The other thing that happens, I'm one of these people who tends to beat myself up if I do something wrong, but once I've written it down and mined it for learning, I'm much quicker to move on and to say, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. Okay, tomorrow I'll do something different.
So this comes under the heading of we learned so much more from our failures than from our successes.
Exactly. And people who don't admit to their failures are really missing an opportunity because there's so much to be mined and allows you to really propel yourself forward much more quickly.
All right, last topic for you. I want to talk a little bit about luck because I recently learned that you have a view of luck that is entirely dissimilar from my view of luck.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What's your view of luck?
My view of luck is luck is something that sort of happens to you and you really can't do much about it. Luck is luck. If you have good luck, if you have bad luck, it's luck. It's ephemeral. It's outside of your purview and control. But you seem to have a fundamentally different view of what luck is. So I'd love to talk about that a little bit because as many entrepreneurs will tell you, some of them just say, we were darn lucky.
You know, it's so funny. I grew up in a family where I have debated this topic with my dad for decades. My father was a guy who would always say, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get. I grew up with that idea that you work hard.
You can make your luck.
You make your luck. People love to say, you know, luck favors the prepared mind. It's like, what does that mean? I have really been observing this very carefully over the last couple of decades and realize that people—
You're a luck scholar.
I just am so fascinated with it. And one of the things, again, it goes back to terminology, because people conflate fortune, chance, and luck.
So this gets back to creativity, imagination,
exactly,
and innovation.
Exactly.
So similar, the words matter, and you've got to be precise. With these fuzzy sort of concepts, you have to be precise with your definitions.
Exactly. And people conflate them, and so they think they have less agency than they really do. So, for example, fortune. I'm fortunate to have been brought up in a wonderful family. I'm fortunate to have been born in this place and time. These are things that are out of my control. Chance is something you had to actually do something. I had to buy a lottery ticket. I needed to apply to college. Yes, there was uncertainty and there were other factors that were out of my control, but I had to do something to set things in motion, right? I can't do something to affect my eye color, but I can do something to affect my chances of getting a job. And then luck is something over which you have much more control. We make our own luck. I believe that luck is much more like the wind that is always blowing than a lightning strike that comes rare and dramatic. And that you can do things to build a sail to catch those winds of luck.
Because the vast majority of people, given the metaphors that you just cited, would say the bolt of lightning as opposed to the wind. Because the wind's there pretty much all the time.
That's the point. And we are always walking into every room. I have a colleague of mine in Chile, and he said something I thought was totally brilliant. He said, there's $1 million in every room. It's up to you to find it. And I truly believe that. I think every situation offers you incredible opportunities, but the point is, we usually miss them. For example, if I don't have my sail up, I don't even know that wind went by.
But how does one put one's metaphorical sail up?
Okay. So there are lots of things you can do. One is you can take some risks. You can take some small risks that get you out of your comfort zone, right? Putting yourself out there. So for example, I could have said, you know, it's kind of a risk, Howard, you know, doing this podcast. I'm a little nervous. I'd rather not. Or I can say, you know what? I'm a little nervous, but I'm going to do it. I'll put myself out there. Who knows what will happen as a result of this podcast? I'm taking a small risk, gotten me out of my comfort zone, and hopefully a few people will listen to this, and maybe some interesting opportunities will come my way that never would have happened if I hadn't talked to you today.
You made your luck.
I made my luck. And there are lots of different types of risks. There are physical risks, social risks, financial risks, emotional risks, intellectual risks, political risks, creative risks. So this is very nuanced. You can take some risks. You also need to understand that the world is really small, and the relationships you build with other people are incredible, powerful levers for increasing your luck. So if I help you out with something, then you know what? When I call you up and say, Howard, you know, can you do me this favor? It's much more likely that you're going to say, you know what? I would be delighted.
Sure.
Right? So obviously that seems like a simple thing, but the world is made up of those relationships, and understanding that doing things for other people and showing appreciation to other people is an enormous lever for catching the winds of luck. And there are lots of other things that you can do. I spend a lot of time thinking about the physics of luck. The world is a set of cause and effect relationships. We're in this dance, constant dance with the world. And if you understand that dance, you are much more likely to tempt luck your way. I know we kind of mixed metaphors there, but that was okay.
I'm all about mixing metaphors.
I was being creative.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm not sure if I'm fortunate, lucky, or it was sort of an element of chance, but having you on the show has been just an absolute delight. So thank you so very much.
I know that I'm incredibly lucky. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM Insight 121. Listen anytime, on demand, with the SiriusXM app.